welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier.
I'm Peter Johnson.
And we have got a fantastic show for our listeners today. Today we are talking to Bill Sharpe. Peter does a wonderful interview with Bill, and it's actually going to cover the next two shows.
We're splitting it in half because it kind of ran a little bit long.
Now, before we get into that, I want to mention our website, promoneytalk.com. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list. Mailing list subscribers get an alert every time we put a new show out. And in the future, we may have promotions or other information that we give to our mailing list subscribers. One new thing that we're doing, Peter, is working with Voice Indigo, a company that helps listeners get podcasts on their cell phones.
Very cool.
Oh, it's really
state of the art.
It's really neat. They've got a great program. You can get Pro Money Talk on your cell phone if you'd like just by going to our website. There's a button there that says mobilize the latest episode. Simply click on the button, you type in your cell phone number, and that's it. You'll get it on your cell phone.
Now, is that just hearing the latest episode?
You can go back and get all episodes that way. But on the homepage, it defaults to the latest episode. But you can go to the Voice Indigo website, and for Pro Money Talk, it'll have all our shows there.
So when people ask me, do I have to have an iPod to listen to your podcast, we'll say, no, not only do you not have to have an iPod, you don't even need to have a computer necessarily. You just need a telephone, basically.
Just a telephone. It's really neat. And you can send the show to other people on their cell phone via your cell phone if you have a show that you really like. Now, one thing that we have started with Pro Money Talk and that we're encouraging our listeners to do is to phone in and call with questions. We've got a phone number now. It just records it in MP3 format, sends it to us on the computer. And what we want to do is highlight questions from our listeners. In the past, they've sent it in via email, and we've tried to verbalize it. But I think it'll be a little more fun if you can actually hear the listener's voice, and we can answer the question on air.
Yeah, and I noticed that the email link for contacting us on the website disappeared or something a couple of weeks ago. So we apologize for that, and it should be back any day now.
Well, yeah, and we hope to have it up hopefully by the time the show goes on air. But if not, the phone number you can call us at is area code 206-250-3428. And if we get enough phone calls, we may even do sort of interstitial type of shows where we highlight three or four or five phone calls and just answer questions on a show.
We've got plenty of guest experts lined up for specialized questions that we may not have the expertise for.
Yeah, and I think that'll be good value to our listeners. I hope so. Let us know what you think. One more thing that I'd like to mention is our listeners provide us fantastic feedback. We get emails from listeners. Hopefully we'll get phone calls from listeners, not just with questions, but with great feedback. And I want to highlight one of our listeners, and that's Evan Chin. Evan is local to the Bay Area, and him and his brother have been dedicated listeners from the start. And Evan's given us great feedback about audio quality and how to improve, and he's really taken a lot of time and energy to help the show out.
Yeah, it's amazing and very helpful to get detailed feedback on, you know, how we can do things better. And we just appreciate the community out there.
Yeah, and it's not just Evan. We've gotten great feedback on all sorts of topics from all sorts of people, and we're really humbled. We really appreciate it. So thank you very much, and keep it coming. Now on to the fun stuff here. Peter, why don't you talk a little bit about the interview that you did with Bill, and maybe tell us a little bit about Bill as well.
Well, in this episode of Pro Money Talk, we take a big step back and look at the underpinnings of the science of investing with Nobel Prize-winning educator and researcher Bill Sharpe. Without getting too technical in the discussion, we explored some of the basic concepts of investing and the implications for investors who want to avoid major pitfalls and pursue an intelligent approach to building portfolios. I think there's really something for everyone here in this show, from the beginner to the professional.
Well, I listened to the show, of course, and I really got a lot out of it. Partially, you know, as a professional, I'm just in awe that we're listening to Bill Sharpe. But there was really some good information in there, I agree, for everybody.
We're very, very fortunate to have Bill as a guest on Pro Money Talk, and pleased that he took the time to talk to us. He is one of the giants of modern portfolio theory. And more than that, he is a remarkably patient, humble, and kind person, which clearly comes across in the interview. Very thoughtful, and he takes the time to explain things in a very accessible way. So I think that his views provide a touchstone with the expertise behind it that you just don't often have the chance to benefit from. He brings 40 years of perspective to investing markets and investor behavior, and his work helped lay the foundation for the way investment professionals around the world build portfolios and invest money. He's the founder of Financial Engines, and we'll be doing an interview with their chief investment officer, Chris Jones, in a future episode. Mm-hmm. Financial Engines is a company that scientifically and very thoroughly examines the likelihood of successful retirement for people, which is really the big question that everybody faces. How long is my money going to last, and how much do I need to live? And here at Pro Money Talk, our intention from the beginning was to bring information straight from the horse's mouth, because there's no better source for understanding the nuances and getting a clear picture of important financial planning concepts.
I agree. And I'm sure if Bill listens to this, he's going to appreciate being called a horse. But I think what's impressive about Bill is not just his incredible knowledge, but that he wants to, I mean, he really has spent his career trying to share that with people. He's not the type of person who tries to hoard the information and keep it to himself. I mean, Financial Engines is something for everybody. He's written books. He's worked at Stanford University. So he's really spent his career trying to help people.
Well, there's actually quite a bit of free stuff on his website, including the pre-publication version of his, I guess, seventh book that's coming out, and some free software that he put together himself to run some of these different analyses where people can sit down and actually play with information that goes into markets and investor behavior and price setting and do experiments of their own. And I think he mentioned to me during the interview that he thought he earned something less than minimum wage working on that, because it took a long time.
Yeah.
So just very great contributor to the body of knowledge.
Well, I think our listeners are probably sick of hearing us talk and really want to get into it here. So without further ado, here's an interview that Peter conducted with Bill Sharp.
Well, we're here today with Bill Sharp to talk about portfolios, investors, returns, risk, the whole ball of wax. Appreciate you being on the show.
It's my great pleasure.
So just to kind of kick things off, what kinds of bottom line things have we learned about risk and return in the last 40 plus years?
How long do you have? Well, I think the important breakthroughs came, and your timing is quite right, in the 1950s. In the 1950s, two different approaches were created, really, to dealing formally, explicitly, and ultimately empirically with risk. One is the quite well-known so-called mean variance approach, Harry Markowitz's work, in which the idea was, as your question suggests, to think about an investment as providing return and risk. Return in the sense of, well, what's my best guess as to how I'm going to do? And risk, how bad could it be? What sort of range is there around that expected return? The other approach, created by Ken Arrow and Gerard Debreu, the so-called state preference approach, said, well, let's think about, at least formally, all the possible things that could happen, and then think about how we would value, in terms of our own preferences, this particular set of possible outcomes or that particular set. So it's a much more detailed view. The two can be related one to the other. That the idea is that when you think about an investment, don't think about the investment as, this is going to give me 12%. Because unless it's a very unusual investment, you don't know what it's going to give you. It could give you 12 or 10 or 15 or minus 10 or 30. And what you have to do at the end of the day is think about the range of possible outcomes associated with that investment, how likely the different outcomes may be, and whether that's something you want to do.
So as a practicing professional, I have to actually put real money to work for my clients. And certainly modern portfolio theory has been a tremendous help to us because we do look at the big picture. We look at more than one asset class, obviously. We look at the three main elements of modern portfolio theory, the expected returns over some period of time, the riskiness or the variation in returns of that asset class, and the correlation between the different asset classes to give some idea. And a while back, several years ago, I think it was at a Schwab conference, I heard you speak about, it was the time when portfolio optimization or asset allocation optimization was being done on computers, I think commonly. And you said, we know more about risk than we do about return. And I took that to mean that when we use these optimizers that we should aim for the risk control and let the return fall where it would. Because if we went just purely for return, then it would probably take us into the land of what's done best in the last 10 years.
Well, your question has a number of ingredients. Let me take them in turn. What I probably meant when I said at the Schwab conference was that history is a better guide to future risk than history is a guide to future expected return. That history tells us a lot more about the risk of an investment, the extent to which investment A is likely to move with or separately from investment B, the correlation you mentioned, than it does about what is the expected return on investment A or investment B. Basically, what you're getting with the expected return, if you look at the past, you're getting some draws out of the hat. And while the range of those draws may be pretty predictive of the possible range of the next draw, the average return in the past is likely to be a pretty poor estimate of sort of the central tendency or the expected return for the next draw. So what I would argue is that history can help a lot in things like risk, correlations, the extent to which, say, a manager is likely to move his portfolio more with value stocks, say, than growth stocks. But when it comes to the expected return on a single investment or a portfolio of investments, you need to use history and good investment theory.
So as a practicing professional, I look at the history and I put a little more credence into the history of the risk of the asset or asset class because of your comments largely. But it always makes me a little bit nervous to look at history and try to derive my clients' portfolios from it because history is limited in what we know. Even the Ibbotson studies that go back to 1926 is a relatively short time frame in the history of mankind and civilization. So there's always a little bit of nervousness, it makes an investment professional humble, I think, if they look at that and say, we're basing our constructing the portfolio on these somewhat limited histories, especially in the international arena. I think the indexes have only been around since 75 or so. Bonds changed their character in the 70s from being sort of low risk to higher risk. We know that things change. So two questions. One is, how much credence can we put in these historical numbers? And number two is, how do we judge and make inferences going forward? You know, I'll get to another question in a minute if need be, but you talked about keeping asset percentages constant kind of leads you to something other than a passive return.
Again, let me, if I may be a little specific and talk about, as I think you know, I'm involved with a company that does these things for as a daily activity, Financial Engines. And let me tell you just a few of the aspects of how we address these issues, because we have this problem every day, as you do. We certainly use history. There's no question about that. We use the history of asset class returns. We use the history of mutual fund returns. We use the history of stock returns. And we learn a lot from history. And in particular, history tells us a lot about, gives us a lot of information that's helpful in predicting future risks, correlations, as we've been saying. History tells us a lot, say, about the expense ratio of a mutual fund. It's a very good predictor of the future expense ratio and turnover, and that's germane in predicting the returns on that mutual fund. When it comes to the expected return on a stock, a mutual fund, an asset class, then we use a combination of history, primarily the history of the risks and the correlations involved with that asset or investment, and what we know happens in at least a reasonably efficient capital market investment theory, and importantly, I would say crucially importantly, the current market values of the asset classes. You think about it, the current market value of Japanese stocks vis-a-vis, say, the current market value of European stocks distills the opinions of huge numbers of investors around the world as to the future prospects for Japan vis-a-vis Europe. It basically tells you the collective opinion about the future, and there we know the wisdom of crowds is such that that's an opinion you ought to pay a lot of attention to. So we incorporate in our prediction procedures those market values every single month. And that, combined with serious investment theory, provides much better, we believe, predictions of the future, returns and risks. And I might say also, when you're looking at, say, at mutual fund performance, you don't want to look at that particular fund's historic average performance, because that combines both information about the manager's skill and also luck, and also what's gone on with the asset classes they're invested in. And so we try to sort all that out, take out the asset class effect, relate that to the asset classes for the future, but then look at the residual, sort of the non-asset or idiosyncratic return, and ask how much of that is likely due to skill and how much to luck. And then we project for the future the skill part, because the luck is just going to show up as a plus or a minus. We incorporate that in our risk estimates. So I think the key thing is history plus theory, plus the terribly important information contained in market values. And I think if you don't have all three ingredients, you just aren't making predictions that are as good as the predictions that can be made, and I would argue should be made.
And we're going to be talking about financial engines in a future show, interviewing Chris Jones, right. And we appreciate that. Well, a couple of interesting points. You talk about the wisdom of crowds, and they set probably pretty, on average, pretty good estimates of what an asset class or a market is worth. So given that, well, first of all, do you look at the price-earnings ratios, price-to-book, the relative valuations that way? And if Japan is cheaper than Europe and the average investor thinks so, do you, say, place a little bit more money in Japan on the assumption it's going to go up, or do you consider that's totally efficient and you really can't outperform?
Well, I think it kind of depends on what desk you're sitting at. Are you trying to help investors invest in markets on the assumption that markets are pretty good at valuing things? Nobody knows exactly what any investment's going to be worth in the future, because that's why we have risk. So to say that you know what it's going to produce in the future, I don't know that. You don't know that for the vast majority of investments. But the question is, do you want to help an investor invest in markets as they are on the assumption that prices are as good a reflection of future prospects as one can get? And that's an important function, and a lot of investment advisors and financial planners take that as their main, if not their sole function. Or do you want to say, well, I kind of think that I've got a little bit better information or possibly a better ability to process available information than does the crowd, the average investor, and therefore I'm going to make some bets. So, the words are perhaps overly simplistic, but it's an investing issue versus a betting issue. And, a great number of counselors do both. They help their clients by investing their money in markets, assuming the markets are reasonably efficient, but they also make a little bet here, a little bet there. They underweight Japan, they overweight Europe. If you take a pure efficient market view, then the fact that the P.E. ratio may be higher in one country than another is presumably not relevant and germane information. The countries are, the reason it's higher presumably is because the average investor, the consensus of investors, figures that earnings are going to grow more. P.E. is, after all, current price over current earnings, and the current price presumably reflects estimates of future earnings. And so one could just say, I don't need that information. I'm not going to use it when I advise my clients. And somebody who takes an efficient market view or a nearly efficient market view generally looks at the market values. That's a much more important piece of information than the price earnings ratios.
There are two points that come to mind. One is that, in my opinion, you don't really need to beat the markets to do fine. If you participate in the markets, that's the important thing. I don't know why there seems to always be a horse race going on to see who can beat the market, because you can do just fine without that. The other is that some years ago I went to Santa Monica and took the DFA orientation and training, the Dimensional Fund Advisors group down there, and they're very strong, efficient market adherents, really. Saying that it's impossible to beat the market, and I think that's their stand, if I'm not misquoting. And I wrestled with that because I'm kind of a semi-efficient market kind of a guy, and I really wrestled with it, and I came out with the markets may not be totally efficient, but they probably know more than I do because there are millions of smart people out there.
Well, let me tell them, if you'll indulge me, let me tell you a little story, and I came on this in a wonderful book, which I'd recommend to your listeners, called The Wisdom of Crowds, and then has a longer title, but that's the key part of it, by James Surowiecki. And I came on this particular story there, and then I tracked it down and read the original. Francis Galton was a fascinating guy who invented regression and correlation and, most unfortunately, eugenics. And the story is that he was at a fair, county fair, and saw a contest. And on the stand was this huge, well, it was called an ox, but think a big cow, I guess, by present standard. And it was alive. And the deal was you paid a pence to submit a bid as to what you thought the ox would weigh when it was slaughtered and fully dressed. And the winner got some amount of money, I'm not sure what. And so, as Surowiecki tells it, Galton observed this, and he said, well, look, some of these people may know something that are engaging in this contest, but most of them are city slickers. They don't know anything. There are going to be some really crazy entries. So being a guy who was obsessed with numbers, he arranged with the promoter to get all the little slips of paper after the contest was over and the ox had been slaughtered and the winner had been paid. And he then tabulated it, and the article was published in Nature, the British science journal, in 1907. And Wonders of the Web, I typed into my search engine that information, and there was a copy of the original article, which is fascinating to read, has some wonderful quotes. But the interesting thing was, yes, Virginia, the estimates were all over the map. But the median, and at that time it was too hard to compute an average because Galton didn't have a calculator or a computer, so he just took the median. But the median estimate was within 1% of the true weight. Sawecki says Galton was surprised at this. That's not apparent in the article, but the article is fascinating, and he titled the article Vox Populi, The Voice of the People. And his point was a bunch of people, each with only partial information, some very skilled, some not skilled at all, can at least on average come up with a remarkably good estimate of something where there's a lot of uncertainty. And that's basically the thesis of the efficient market crowd, that, yeah, we know some really nutty investors, and we know that a lot of investors have very small amounts of information. But if a bunch of people come to market, each with some information, none with all, that's available, some skilled, some not skilled, then just the power of numbers and the competitive process can result in prices that reflect all the information that's available and reflect it very well. In some of my recent research, I've been doing simulations where that point really comes through very, very clearly.
So the implications for investors are?
The implications for investors are devote certainly the majority of your effort in doing exactly what you described, helping investors take the risks that are appropriate for them and get the premia, the risk premia that in an efficient market go with risks that have to be borne by someone. I mean, the big messages of investment theory are that there will be a reward for bearing risk, but not just any risk. The kind of risk that has to be borne by somebody, the risk, if to oversimplify, of doing badly in bad times, and that in an efficient market, prices will adjust until there are rewards for bearing that kind of risk, measured in simple terms by beta, a number that I'm sure you know you've talked about before, and we can talk about again. But there are premia for bearing risk of a particular kind, and if you're able and to bear that risk, if you're comfortable with it, you should achieve that risk premium. And there are a lot of jobs to do, especially for a personal advisor in helping people deal with their particular circumstances. If you're investing a 401k account and your spouse has another 401k account, you need to complement that. If you have a job in the tech sector in Silicon Valley, you should take that into account and not put a lot of your money in tech stocks, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to go beyond that and do a little betting because you really think that the average investor, the market as a whole, has got something pretty wrong, just doesn't understand what might happen in the Middle East, and that you think you have a better understanding of that than is reflected in prices, then you're going to do some tilts away from what you would do otherwise to take that hopefully superior information into account. But I would think that it behooves one to be modest about one's ability to beat the crowd.
I would say amen to that. I think that's good advice for people because we not only have professionals listening, but we do have individuals. So I want this to be instructive to them. Well, you're just talking about the different modeling that you've done and the way things work and how investors earn money through taking on risk and so on. Good place to talk about the book that you're writing right now. The title is Investors and Markets, Portfolio Choices, Asset Prices, and Investment Advice, Princeton University Press. When will the book be coming out?
We're expecting it to be available in print by the end of this year, 2006. Probably October or November, it's looking like.
And who is the intended audience for your book?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I guess as the book evolved, and it evolved over a period of time, it came from a series of lectures I was invited to give at Princeton. But as it has evolved, I think it's intended for people who will teach investments at various levels, and for those who have learned more traditional theory and want to get a somewhat different take. This is a different approach than is taught typically at the undergraduate level, at the MBA level. It's my attempt to provide a way of looking at some of the issues associated with investments using a structure that tends to be taught at the PhD level these days at universities, using a lot of, to me at least, difficult mathematics. And so what I tried to do was to look at these problems using simpler mathematics and using a simulation program that students, faculty, practitioners, anybody can use to investigate certain aspects of the investment process. So I would guess that it will be read more by people who are teaching investments than by people who are practitioners. But I'm hopeful. I'm giving a talk to a group of practitioners actually this coming Monday, and we'll see how that goes. But I'm hoping to enlist practitioners as well as ordinary investors if they're willing to take the time and effort to go through it. I've tried to make the book quite accessible.
And you've also put the computer program that you ran the simulations in online. And I didn't have time to play with it, but I think that's a really sort of value-added multimedia approach to this learning process.
Yes, that turned out to be a monumental undertaking. When I first took on the project of the lectures and the book, I was just going to write a little program here or there for my own use. And that took on a life of its own, and I finally got a program to the point where it provided the backbone for the lectures when I gave the lectures. But it was written in a wonderful language called MATLAB, which is available but expensive. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to make this available to the world, which is what I very much wanted to do, I'm going to have to write it in a language that's free. And also it has to be fast, and it has to be reasonably bulletproof. So that ended up as a year and a half long project.
Gosh.
But it is available. It is free. And it is, I believe, very easy to use. And thus far, the early returns are that people who've used it have found it easy to use and interesting and useful.
There are some online Java calculators, I guess, for sharp ratio and for the CAPM, and it was kind of fun for me to get online and play with those, because just trying to wrestle meaning out of words where there's a lot of dense content is quite a job.
When I was teaching, when the web was first available for my course, I wrote some... Not Java. They were actually their JavaScript, which is slower, but nonetheless functional. I wrote some simple JavaScript programs, if you will, for asset allocation, performance analysis, style analysis, what have you. And they're not very pretty, but they're on my website and have been now for at least 10 years, I suppose. And what never ceases to amaze me is that from time to time somebody will actually do an asset allocation exercise for a huge pension fund, you know, billions and billions of dollars using my simple little JavaScript programs, because they do work. And nice thing about JavaScript is that the source code is right there in the web page. So anybody, in the case of my simulator, which is compiled C code, I've made the source code available as well on my site, so people who want to look at it or, for that matter, modify it are free to do it. But the JavaScript is there, and those programs, and I've got a little annuity calculator. Again, they're simple pedagogical devices, but they actually can be used to solve real problems, although that's not the way I would go for, you know, serious problems.
You'd buy the official version and not take the free web version?
I have not done an official version of my little calculators, but there are plenty of things out there. Plus, you can do a lot in Excel these days. Excel has a very good optimization program.
Mm. Well, you've also, I don't know if we want to put this in the podcast, but you've also made the draft of the book available online.
I have. My arrangement with the publisher was that I could have the draft of the book online up to the point where the book is available tangibly. And I understand they're going to make it available through Amazon and perhaps their website so that you can see enough of it to decide if you want to buy it. Plus, it is a university press, so it's not going to be egregiously priced. I don't know the final price. That'll depend on the production costs, I guess, in part, but it will be reasonably priced.
Well, we don't want to undercut sales for sure.
Well, this is, believe me, my chance of making minimum wage out of this project, given what I've done in the last 3 years, is very, very small indeed. This is a labor of love on my part.
Well, I enjoyed looking the book over. I didn't get all the way to the end, but I did learn about looking at the big picture and about how everything relates from the person, from the microeconomic to the macroeconomic, I guess you could say, using the terms loosely, all the things that go into making prices work and the fact that they do tend toward an equilibrium state.
Well, yeah, the way the and I write about other things as well, but the way the simulator works, you create people. It's like The Sims, if you know that thing, but without the graphics and without some of the, you know, racier parts. But you create people and you give them what I call positions, predictions, and they basically, and preferences. So you can create them and give them these various attributes. Position, I have salary that comes, say, from a tech company. I have preferences, I'm very risk averse, I want things sooner rather than later, and you give them predictions. I think this particular event is more likely to happen than you think it is. So you give them these characteristics, you give them portfolios to start out with, and then you say, go to it. And you have a market maker that helps them make trades, and they trade and they trade and they trade until you can't get them to trade anymore, and then you look at the outcome and see what you see what the characteristics are of prices, of risks, of returns, of relationships, and you can create a, you know, very rich societies, if you will. Think of this as creating a little society, and see what the characteristics of capital markets and portfolios chosen may be in a capital market that has those characteristics. And from that, I think you can, it's a sort of a hands-on experience in which you can learn a lot about what may happen in real capital markets.
That sounds fascinating.
Well, it's fun. At least it's been a lot of fun for me. It's a lot more fun to use it than it is to create it and get it to work right. But I find it fun, and what little experience I've had working with others using it, they seem to find it fun. And I think it's just a wonderful pedagogical device, and it allows you to go well beyond the limits of the traditional risk-return kinds of approaches that we've been talking about and look at a lot of issues that are of great concern, like what about the small probability of a really ugly event, you know, the big, you know, tail risk, as it's sometimes called, and you can look at that very easily. And again, the mathematics, you know, it's not quite limited to just addition and subtraction, multiplication, division, but it's pretty close to it. So the mathematics are not daunting at all. And it allows you to really think through the economics of investment.
Well, thank you, Peter and Bill, for that. That was great information. And, of course, there's more still to come next week. You can go to our website, promoneytalk.com, and there's going to be more information about the show, including an extensive bio of Bill Sharpe and the links that were mentioned during the show to Financial Engines and other sites.
Yeah, during the show, Bill mentioned some other academics and researchers. We've got links to their sites and to his software and his book, and so quite a bit on there.
Also, while you're at our website, make sure to sign up for the mailing list, and you'll get an alert with all new shows and maybe some special stuff from time to time. And again, if you have any questions stemming from this show or just general financial questions, give us a call. Our number is area code 206-250-3428, and we'll play your question on the air and answer it on the air.
And stay tuned, because we do have some really interesting guests coming up on Pro Money Talk. One in particular that I'll be doing the interview this week covers some big, and I mean really big picture stuff. And some of the other shows are way down to the nitty-gritty, including a tool that can assist investors to keep their relationship with their investment advisor on track.
Yeah, we've got one from a banker who's going to talk to us about small businesses, starting small businesses, how to get loans, that sort of thing. So a lot of interesting stuff for our listeners coming up. But obviously the next show is the second half of this interview, and that'll come out in 2 weeks. And we hope you enjoy it. So until then, thanks for listening, and here's to your success.